Följande podcast innehåller språk som kan anses olämpligt för vissa lyssnare. The following podcast contains language that may not be appropriate for all listeners.
You're now tuned in to San Quentin's Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Hey, E, tell everyone how you heard about this story. You really ear hustled this one.
I think it was back like in January. I was in a chow hall and I'm waiting in line for dinner. And it was a couple of dudes behind me, and one was telling the other guy about this 115 he got.
A 115 is a rule violation.
Right, right. Except this wasn't about contraband or fight. This was about an actual escape. So you know it got a little interesting, right? I'm hustling this one.
I'm sure you are.
So I did one of those, I'm not listening to what you're saying things and turn around just so I can really identify the guy. And later, I saw him on a yard, and he was in front of the area where the white guys kick it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an older guy, but he was busting down, doing burpees, getting his money, right?
Nice, nice.
So I waited for him to finish his set, and then I walked over to him, and I'm like, excuse me, sir, my name is Erlon. Can I holler at you for a second? And we start talking, and I told him about the podcast, and I was like, look, man, I was in line the other day, and it was you and another guy, and you was telling him about a 115 you had, and it was a very interesting story.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that you can come down to the studio so we can talk about it. And he was like, no. I'm Erlon Woods, a prisoner at San Quentin State Prison in California.
I'm Nigel Poor, a visual artist who works with incarcerated men at San Quentin.
And together, we're going to take you inside.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
I've been denied 3 times. This is my 4th parole hearing coming up now.
Steve Wilson has been in prison on and off for about 30 years.
He didn't want to talk to us at first because he had that parole hearing coming up. He didn't want to say something that might be used against him.
Which is smart, because if your parole hearing is successful, you get a date. It's what everyone wants, a date to get out of prison. And that's what we're talking about on this episode. What it takes to get out of prison.
So, Erlon, Steve Wilson didn't want to talk to us.
Mm-mm.
This was way back before we even did our first episode. So maybe he didn't know what we were talking about. And honestly, we didn't even know what we were doing.
Maybe. I mean, I explained it to him. You know, I'm like, hey, man. We'll hold this story off until after your parole hearing. And after talking to him like that, he agreed to holler at us.
I thought I had a good chance at parole the last time. I had a low risk of recidivism. I had over 20 years of clean time with no write-ups. I had no violence in my history except my commitment offense in 1979.
Commitment offense. That's the crime that put him in prison in the first place.
In 1979, Steve Wilson murdered his father-in-law on a ranch in California. It was a complicated domestic dispute that we're not going to get into here. But basically, Steve's wife left him and he went to her father's ranch to get her back. But his father-in-law wouldn't allow him on the ranch. So long story short, Steve kidnapped his father-in-law and ended up killing him, shooting him twice, I believe.
It's been almost 40 years since that murder, and Steve's now 73 years old. But it's not just his crime that's keeping him in prison.
Every time I go to the board, there's always this one rule violation at 115 that I got about 30 years ago. And every time I go to the board, they bring it up.
I bet they do. We're going to hear more about that rule violation. But first, here's what's waiting for Steve when he goes to the board. This is Danny Plunkett, who has been incarcerated for 27 years for murder and robbery.
You have to go in there. You have to be accountable for your actions. prior to the commitment offense, the commitment offense, and after the commitment offense. And you sit down in front of the commissioner, deputy commissioner, who hold your life in their hands.
Danny just went to the board, so the memory is fresh.
You go to your first parole hearing here at San Quentin. You go in the same direction that you would go to a visit. You've gone that way many times, but this is a whole new experience. You, emotions, nerves are just raw. And you've got your packet under your arm, all your stuff, support letters, parole plans, relapse prevention plan, maybe a couple book reports, an essay that you've written. And as you're headed to where the visiting is, you make a left. And you have to stand there and wait for an officer to come get you. He takes you through a gate. You go up a short flight of stairs, and there's a holding cell. There's a wooden bench, and you sit on that bench.
I can honestly remember sitting in the holding cell, waiting for them to call me to go to the board.
Phil Melendez was on a recent episode about unwritten rules of race. He's been incarcerated for 20 years for a double murder. He also just went to the board.
And, you know, they call you, they say, hey, Mr. Melendez, they're ready for you. And I remember my heart sinking, the butterflies times a million. I felt like there was maybe a billion butterflies in my stomach. I felt like electric, like my whole body was like flowing with energy, but nervous energy, not such a good energy.
If you're lucky and you get a date at the hearing, those butterflies don't necessarily go away. Ron Self was on our first episode talking about the cellie from hell. He served 23 years for attempted murder. He actually got a date recently, and he's scheduled to be released soon, but...
They have up to 120 days to review it, and yeah, it's cockroach motel, easy to get in, hard to get out. It's kind of how I look at it. It's a slow process getting out.
It's slow because your date goes through a review process, and as Ron knows, they can take your date away from you at any time.
So there's this euphoric feeling. I mean, it's like, wow, I'm really found suitable. This is not my reality, what's about to come happen. And so then another type of stress starts to set in. It's like, am I going to somehow get the date taken away like other people have? I think it's worse stress.
Why?
Because you don't know. You think you're literally walking on rice paper. If you were walking on eggshells before, you're walking on rice paper now. It's anything can cause it to go sideways.
Waiting. Prison is all about waiting. And then when something finally happens, goes your way, you get a date, you still gotta wait.
S-T-E-P-H-E-N is the correct spelling. Steve for short.
Steve's been waiting a long time, and you can see why he's anxious about his parole hearing.
Yep, it's that rule violation. The parole board is going to know all about it, and it's a big one. We're going to hear about that right now, and we're also going to check back in with the other guys to see how they fared with the board.
After he murdered his father-in-law, Steve Wilson was sentenced to 25 years to life, and he started serving his time at California's second most famous prison.
Well, I arrived at Old Folsom in October of 1982, and after I established myself and felt comfortable, I began making plans to escape.
He started with research. In the prison library, Steve found some books about escape attempts from Old Folsom.
There had been dozens and dozens of attempts to escape out of Old Folsom that had never been successful.
Steve said that he thought these books were in the library to show guys how impossible it was to escape.
But Steve learned something very important from these failed attempts.
They failed because somebody told. Whenever there was more than one person, somebody chickened out. And I had those same emotions at the end myself. Am I going to do this or am I not? And the one way to chicken out is you drop a kite on yourself and say, there's this escape attempt, and everybody gets busted. And that's what I read in the books. My fail-safe method was don't tell anyone.
Steve was working in an industrial warehouse in a prison, and that's where he saw his opportunity.
They received a gigantic exhaust fan, the type that goes on top of a building.
Weighed about 1,400 pounds.
The fan was there for repairs, which meant that eventually it was going to get shipped out.
And the more I looked at this fan, the more I realized this would be the way to go.
There was an 18-inch opening underneath the fan. With practice, Steve found that he could squeeze inside it and not be seen.
From that point on, I just focused on getting enough money hidden away and waiting my opportunity. Over this period of time, I had accumulated $2,000. My dad would visit me. He had $100 bills rolled up inside of balloons, so tight they're about the size of pills. My dad would just drop them out of his hand into the soda can, and I would drink them, swallow them, wait until the next day and fish them.
Ugh.
Yep. But now he had money and a plan. Then one day, his boss told him that the fan was getting ready to ship. So when no one was looking, Steve crawled inside.
I can remember very distinctly, August 2nd, 1984. It was already hot. And I'm in this fan. I'm set down in the middle of the floor, and there's two or three officers and pre-staff walking around. And one of them, my boss, comes over, and he's standing next to the fan, and he tells the guys, he says, okay, load the fan now. And so my heart's, you know, beating so loud, I'm thinking that they've got to hear it because this is a scary situation. And I'm sweating profusely. Drops of sweat are falling off my head and hitting the cardboard. And to me, it sounds like somebody's thump, thump, thump. And so I'm thinking, I'm sure they can hear that out there.
But they didn't hear him. And the fan was loaded into the trailer of the truck. The truck left the prison and Steve was out. But this was just the beginning of his escape.
Yeah, we interviewed him for about 2 hours, and he remembers everything that happened that day, like when he realized he was locked inside the trailer.
This is where I made my mistake in my planning.
It took him a while to find a way out.
I'm sitting there, and there's these little pin pricks of light coming down from the roof in the trailer, and little dust motes floating around. And I'm thinking, where in the world is that coming from? And I look up at the ceiling, and there's all this duct tape.
He pulled the duct tape down and popped out.
Then he hitched a ride, and the trucker who gave him a ride was pulled over by the highway patrol because he had skipped a way station.
But Steve kept his cool, and he made it to San Jose, where he bought food and clothing.
I would imagine it was to be about 12 o'clock by now, and I was starting to feel paranoia and thinking that every little airplane that flew over, every car was looking for me, and so I found a big clump of bushes, and I curled up in the bushes and took a little nap.
He got up into the mountains, and it took him weeks, but he walked, and I mean he walked, almost 500 miles, all the way to the town of Ramona, just north of San Diego.
Steve's originally from Florida, but he lived in the San Diego area when he was in the service. He hadn't told anyone in the prison about his plans, but he had told his mom and dad.
They came and visited me, and they said they hadn't been notified that I had escaped, other than the fact that, you know, I told them I was going to. So mom gave me some more money. We said our goodbyes. I said, I don't know when the next time I'll see you. They left. I'm kind of afraid to be moving around because this is, you know, considered my hometown. And obviously the cops should have been notified.
Steve bought a car and he started driving. He made it to El Paso on the first day and then kept going.
When I got to Austin, I saw builder's cranes for high-rise construction. And when I saw those, I knew that I'd get a job. And I knew I wasn't going to go any further.
Steve Wilson became one of few men to successfully escape from old Folsom State Prison. He was out of prison, but he wasn't really free. The authorities were after him, and he knew they weren't going to stop looking for him. Ever.
Yeah, you know, and he wouldn't be able to see his mom and dad again. He couldn't hang out with old friends. And he was definitely going to have to assume other names along the way. And he'd always be looking over his shoulder. I mean, he wasn't going to have a normal life.
Nah, that's just it. If you escape and you don't get killed trying to do so, you're not going to get what all of us want, a chance at a normal life. And that's something that a lot of us behind bars fantasize about, getting out and leading a normal life.
What are some of the things you think about when you fantasize about your life when you're out?
off the top of my head, it's unrealistic, but I think about just getting out of San Quentin, jumping in the water, and swimming to my yacht and going around the world.
Nice. We asked some other guys in our story what they fantasize about, and they're not quite as ambitious as you, E. Here's Philip.
My idea of freedom in its most simplest and most beautiful form is me sitting on a couch with the wife on one side, the kids on the other side, and we're all just sitting there, probably having came back just from getting ice cream and watching The NeverEnding Story.
I kind of like that movie, too. Here's what Ron's been fantasizing about.
I look forward to falling in love and just holding that person. And I don't even mean in a sexual way, just to feel that person, the warmth of that person. I look forward to that. And on the lighter side, I want to get a dog.
We're going to take a break here, and when we get back, we're going to hear what kind of life Steve led as an escaped felon.
The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. Hear a feed from episodes across NPR podcasts that center Black voices. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Being on escape, probably the first thing you wake up with and go to bed with every night is, wow, I made it through another day. But there becomes a point in time and where you start to feel comfortable.
After his escape from Old Folsom, Steve made his way to Austin. He found work there and met his future wife.
This really nice lady. We got along really well. And after a year or so, we moved from Texas back down to my home in Florida. And I told her who I was. And we bought a piece of ground. We bought an acre in a gated community on a lake. And I built a house. I had built a new family with her and her son, who I was with and raised from the time he was 2 until he was almost 11. And her family that adopted me as one of them.
Sounds kind of like a normal life. Not really.
I've always realized when I escaped that, you know, it's only going to last so long. There will be an end. And so I kind of burnt my candle at both ends.
It lasted for years. Steve ran a small maintenance and construction company. He traveled and he fit in with his community. Now, it sounds kind of normal, right?
And every week, we went shopping in town.
Not really.
I picked up the TV guide one time as we were in the checkout lane, and I looked for America's Most Wanted. I think it was playing on Sunday nights then. And the first thing I saw was my name, Steve Wilson, will be featured. My heart stopped.
So TV Guide and America's Most Wanted tipped off the fugitive Steve Wilson.
Steve immediately went on the run again. He moved to Australia, then to England, where he convinced his wife to join him.
I've got my British citizenship, and I've got my Australian citizenship, and I figured out how to bring you over here and make you a citizen too. And she says, okay. I said, next thing I need you to do is to empty out my account, which she had her name on. And I said, bring me my money. I said, just make sure you don't take more than $10,000 at a time. Take less.
Either she didn't listen to him or she didn't think it was important. Mm-mm. Because she ended up taking out more than $10,000.
In one withdrawal.
And that was the problem.
The FBI was monitoring that account. They tipped off Scotland Yard, and she was followed from the moment she got off that plane.
Yep.
When she met up with Steve at the hotel in London, he got arrested.
Immediately.
Well, I escaped on August 2nd, 1984. 8 years later, in 1992, I was returned to New Folsom and put in the hole.
So that's Steve's 115. That's the rule violation that will come up at his parole hearing, and he'll have to answer for that yet again.
Yep, and he's also going to have to talk about his life before he murdered his father-in-law. He'll have to talk about the murder itself. And he'll also have to talk about what he's been doing since he's been back in prison after his escape.
Yeah, guys have to explain what sort of work they've been doing to understand themselves, to change. There's a whole bunch of vocabulary for this inside of prison.
Yeah, you guys talk about like insight and accountability all the time.
And some guys really do take it on, but some guys don't. Mm-hmm. And the board is going to be listening and looking hard to determine what's really going on inside.
What do I think my chances are at parole? I think that I've prepared myself. I've done some deep study and research into myself, and I understand what it was and the way my belief system was that allowed me to take such a drastic step. I do courses over and over again. I do AA, NA, and been doing it for over 10 years. Even though I have gotten everything from it that I can get, I mean, I live it every day. I ask myself every day a question. I question myself, and I say, you know, have I addressed my defects? Am I trying to control anybody? Am I trying to take advantage? And then I also ask myself, have I done anything positive today?
For myself, I would say I did a lot of writing.
This is Danny Plunkett again. He's been involved with restorative justice programs, which is about dialogue between victims and offenders. Here's how he prepared to face the board.
I would just write. I would write about the crime. I would write about who I was leading up to the crime. And also a lot of victim empathy exercises, just trying to write on what it must have been like for them and trying to imagine maybe what it's been like for them since the crime, since the trial. That kind of stuff.
At Danny's parole hearing, he faced a commissioner and a deputy commissioner.
So we walk into the room, and there's directly in front of me, there's two seats. The farthest one my lawyer is sitting in, and then the one that I'm going to sit in. And there's two tables and on the left, and that's where the commissioner and the deputy commissioner. And then the back of the room is just a line of people. And I can't look. I can't look at him.
That row of people behind Danny, they're called VNOCs, Victims Next of Kin. And Danny was not allowed to look at them. He couldn't acknowledge their presence in any way.
Danny can't address anyone except the commissioners.
At Danny's hearing, the victims' representatives got a chance to speak.
And I got to hear a little of the young man that I murdered's life before. And then I got to hear from the victims, two victims who were at the crime, and hear their experiences. And I got it. I got it all. I got to hear the family's history, you know, hear my victim's life growing up in great detail. And, you know, that's really restorative justice, except for the fact that I couldn't look at them. They had family pictures. I couldn't look. And it was really tough not to look. But I got to hear the pain and the heartache and the loss, you know. The empty stocking at Christmas, the empty chair at Thanksgiving. It was a very powerful experience. And I'm very grateful for that.
Guys find out pretty quick if they're getting a date, often within minutes after the hearing. Danny did not get a date.
I struggle with whether or not I deserve to get out of prison because of the harm that I've caused and the life I took that can't be returned and relived. I want out. There's a lot of things I want to do. But on the other hand, I have a pretty good life in here. At San Quentin, I've been able to find me for the first time in my life, somebody that I'm proud of. I have a rich, rewarding life with so many programs and relationships, you know, with people and even some people locally who, you know, I've met since I've been here that come to visit. And outside volunteers, there's so many outside volunteers. So I have a rich life in here. I really look forward to having a rich life out of here.
Danny will have another chance before the board in 3 years. Here's what happened at Philip's hearing. And just a reminder, Philip has been in prison for 20 years for a double murder he committed when he was 19 years old.
One of the things that they said, you know, Mr. Melendez, well, they said that, you know, there's no getting around the crime. It's a horrendous crime, and it is. And I agreed wholeheartedly when he said that, and I agree with it now to this day. But when they talked about suitability factors, you know, they said that you have done a lot of work. You've done a lot of work on yourself. You have insight. And one of the things that I did well, they said, was you didn't minimize anything, which means that, like, when it came to every part of my negative behavior, I owned it and was able to trace it back to my childhood. And that's the insight, too.
Philip's hearing lasted about 3.5 hours.
And, you know, you done talked about all your traumas, and it's painful, it's sad, it hurts. And then you have to wait. And those 15 or 20 minutes just seem like forever. And then they come and get you, and they say, all right, let's reconvene. Sure enough, they walked me in there. They said, Mr. Melendez, we find you suitable for parole. And, you know, you feel the weight of the world come off your chest.
Do you think you deserve to get out?
I don't know about deserving. That's a hard word to really stomach, just based on my accountability, just based on my understanding of my victim's impact, or the impact I had on my victim's lives. I couldn't really say I ever deserve anything, right? Do I want to get out? Absolutely. Do I have a family? Do I have a community that I want to fix and that I want to restore? Yes, absolutely. And for them and for the community, I would like to see myself out. I would like to see myself out, but I don't think I could ever say that I deserve to be out.
The reaction inside of San Quentin to Philip getting his date has been mixed. He says most of his fellow prisoners have been supportive, but he's heard complaints.
One of the worst ones I've heard was like, oh, I can't believe that MF-er got a date. You know, he killed 2 people. And then the only comfort that guy could get is just keep thinking out loud. This is what somebody told me. He kept thinking about it. It's like, well, at least the governor will take his date.
But that didn't happen. In September, Phil Melendez got out of prison and he's living in Northern California.
Maybe he's already had a chance to watch The Neverending Story on the couch with his wife and kids.
Yeah, I'm going to have to catch that movie on my yacht.
And I used to tell myself, you know, I can't wait to get away from these frickin' turds.
Ron Self is still waiting for his date to arrive.
And now it's looking like that's going to happen. I'm finding myself realizing I'm going to miss a lot of these people, especially the veterans.
Before he came to prison for attempted murder, Ron was in the military.
I feel like I'm a little emotional. I feel like I'm leaving them behind. And I don't like that. That bothers me. And it surprises me because I didn't think that would bother me.
Here's the latest on Ron. After he got his date, he had to wait months to see if it would pass review. Just last Friday, he was called to go see his counselor.
I almost threw up. I mean, I could feel it in my throat. It was just like, holy shit. But I get there and the counselor comes running out. And he's like, yeah, the governor reviewed your case today and he took no action. I'm like, cool. So when am I getting out? I don't know. He says, I don't know, but you got to sign these papers.
On October 19, 2017, after 23 years in prison, Ron Self walked free. But I think he's coming back to prison, though.
What? You think he's coming back here for sure?
I do.
Well, you actually are right, because he founded a program, Veterans Healing Veterans, and he's going to be visiting veterans in prisons across the state.
Okay. How you doing today?
I'm a little tired, but I'm healthy.
Back to Steve Wilson and his board hearing. We interviewed him before the hearing and after. It didn't go well for him.
My feelings on that, I was hurt. I really expected to get a date.
He was philosophical about it, though.
It seems that the older that I get, the more I'm kind of living in my memories. I can go any place I want. I can do anything I want. I can relive all my experiences as long as I don't lose my memory. And that is a freedom. They can lock the body up until it dies, but they can't lock the mind up.
Thanks to Steve Wilson for sharing his story with us.
And also big thanks to Danny Plunkett, Philip Melendez, and Ron Self for telling us about their experience with the parole board.
Sound design on this episode was a group effort, with music contributed by Antoine Williams, David Jazzy, E. Phil Phillips, and Erline Woods, myself. Pat Macedi Miller is our outside production advisor. Our story editor is Curtis Fox, and our executive producer for Radiotopia is Julie Shapiro.
We also want to thank Warden Ron Davis and Larry Schneider, who runs the media lab we work in. And as you know, every episode has to be approved by this guy here.
I am Lieutenant Sam Robinson, the public information officer at San Quentin State Prison, and I approve this story, the final episode of season one. I'm really looking forward to hearing, well, maybe I am, I'm not really sure because there's been a lot of work this season, but given that we move forward with season two, I'm really looking forward to see what new stories develop out of Ear Hustle.
It feels so weird to not say next time on Ear Hustle. E, I'm not ready for this.
Me either. But don't get too down, Nige, because we got plans to drop a few surprises in the feed leading up to next season.
And we've heard from so many listeners about the original music we use in our episodes, and we're going to dig into that and share some of those songs in full.
And maybe we might do a Q&A episode or something.
Right. You know, we've been getting so many kites. I've got so many to go through. And I want to give a shout out to Jefferson County Public Schools and the Moore Traditional School specifically, because they have a teacher there that did a project with her class. And we got like 62 kites in one day.
So keep those kites coming and let us know what you want to hear.
Okay, E, I know we can't get specific about what we're working on for next season, but what's one story you want to do?
Ministering on death row.
Ooh, that's a heavy one.
Yeah, that's a deep one. Do you think we're going to get on death row this year?
That's the big question, is if we're going to get up there.
What about you, Nige?
For sure, I want to do a story about L7s, nerds, and fantasy games inside.
Let's just say we got a shitload of work to do over the break, so please stay tuned. Nige will be posting on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and you might find her out there talking about Ear Hustle.
Over the break, I'll continue updating the website, earhustlesq.com. Check out the gallery for new images. And also, we get so many questions about writing to guys inside. Please go to the FAQ section on the website to find out how to do that.
People love mail, and not just the guys at San Quentin.
Thanks to everyone who's listened over the season and supported us in so many ways. You know what I always say to Lieutenant Robinson when I talk about Ear Hustle?
No, what?
The reality of Ear Hustle is bigger than the dream we had when we started.
Damn.
Yeah.
That's deep.
It is. And we've been supported by so many people.
Yeah, we had over 5 million downloads this season.
It's amazing. It's really amazing.
She got all emotional and shit.
Okay.
That's what's up.
Okay.
Can't be seen crying in prison, woman.
Absolutely not. So, again, thanks to everyone who cared enough to listen. I'm Nigel Poor.
And thanks to the entire San Quentin community. I'm Earlonne Woods. Thanks for listening.
Radiotopia. From PR.